Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning and welcome to Blog Talk Radio. This is Saturday Symposium with Dan Wilson. As always, we're going to pass it over to you, Red Skelton, to start it out. Tell us about that teacher you had there in Indiana.
I remember a teacher that I had. Now, I went through the seventh grade. I went to the seventh grade. I left home when I was 10 years old because I was hungry. I work in the summer and I go to school in the winter. But I had this one teacher. It was the principal of the Harrison School in Vincennes, Indiana. To me, this was the greatest teacher, a real sage of my time. Anyhow, he had such wisdom, and we were all reciting the Pledge of Allegiance one day, and he walked over, this little teacher, Mr. Lasswell was his name, Mr. Lasswell, he says, he says, I've been listening to you boys and girls recite the Pledge of Allegiance all semester, and it seems as though it's becoming monotonous to you. If I may... May I recite it and try to explain to you the meaning of each word? I, me, an individual, a committee of one, pledge, dedicate all of my worldly goods to give without self-pity, allegiance, my love and my devotion to the flag, our standard, O glory, a symbol of freedom. Wherever she waves, there's respect, because your loyalty has given her a dignity that shouts, freedom is everybody's job. United, that means that we have all come together. States, individual communities that have united into 48 great states. 48 individual communities with pride and dignity and purpose. All divided with imaginary boundaries, yet united to a common purpose. And that's love for country. And to the Republic. Republic. A state in which sovereign power is invested in representatives chosen by the people to govern. And government is the people. And it's from the people to the leaders, not from the leaders to the people, for which it stands. One nation, meaning so blessed by God, indivisible, incapable of being divided, with liberty, which is freedom, the right of power to live one's own life, without threats, fear, or some sort of retaliation. And justice, the principle or qualities of dealing fairly with others. For all. For all. Which means, boys and girls, it's as much your country as it is mine. And now, boys and girls, let me hear you recite the Pledge of Allegiance. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. Since I was a small boy, two states have been added to our country and two words have been added to the Pledge of Allegiance. Under God. Wouldn't it be a pity if someone said that is a prayer and that would be eliminated from schools too?
Okay, Scott, are you there?
Thank you, Dan. I had the mute button on. I didn't realize I'd pushed that stupid button. Don't you hate it when that happens? I will start my monologue all over again. Good morning and welcome to Contending for Truth Radio. This is Saturday Symposium with Dan Wilson down in Florida. We're going to have a great show. Guess we've got this morning. We interviewed this last week, kind of on the fly. Dan got to chatting with him right before the show. We didn't have a guest, so we brought him on and talked a little bit. But we decided to, for Memorial Day, we were going to make him as our special guest here on Saturday Symposium. You know, we come up on this weekend, and it's a humbling weekend because in the history of our great country, we've lost a lot of great men and women that were willing to fight and give their life for the freedom that we have, and not only our freedom, but freedom abroad. There are people living in Germany and Austria and Vietnam and many other places around the world that our troops have defended their freedom. And many places where men and women have lost their lives. All you got to do is go walk on the beaches of Normandy to really understand the fight in the American military and in men and women that are willing to fight. And this morning we've got Dr. Dubois. Dr. Dubois, I have a hard time pronouncing his name. He was born in the war zone. He was born in Vietnam. And the invasions of the North Vietnamese communist, they had caused total destruction throughout the entirety of his parents' village when he was just 4 years old. So from a very young age, he saw the horridness of what went on in that war. He escaped the communism of Vietnam in June of 1981, and after many attempts, he found freedom in the United States of America in September of 1982. Now, he utilized the freedom and the opportunities of this great nation. He was able to go back to school. He started to learn English as a second language in multiple churches. I have to give a big shout-out to the churches, because when those refugees started coming over here from Vietnam, I was a little boy. And I remember how the three churches encompassed and brought in the Vietnamese families, many of them women and children, minus the male in the family. He went on, though, to obtain an Associate of Applied Science in Data Processing with high honor in the Houston Community College in 1986. He joined the United States Navy in 1987, and he served multiple deployments with his squadron on the United States ship America CV-66. Dr. Du got injured in the line of duty, and he was honorably discharged in 93. Then he had to return to college. And let me tell you, folks, he didn't just go to college. He obtained a degree in the Associate in Arts with high honors in the Florida Community College of Jacksonville, then went on to apply and get accepted into the College of Pharmacy at Nova Southeastern University. He graduated, folks, as a Doctor of Pharmacy in May of 2001. Yes, folks, that brings a tear to my eye, because here's a young boy who watched the horridness of war, saw bloodshed, and Dr. Du is a definite hurdle jumper. He has not let anything in life slow him down. He has not let anything stop him. He is an author. He wrote his own book. And let me tell you, when English is not your first language, to turn around and write a book is not just like you or I sitting down and writing a book. He overjumped that. He overcame that hurdle. He overcame the hurdle of not understanding the language of the new country that he was in. He overjumped the hurdles of a war-torn home country. He was there for the Tet Offensive. He will tell you that story off of the roof of his home with his friends. You know, Dan, Memorial Day is important to you, and it's important to me, because we've lost a lot of young men. And this Monday, we're going to remember their bravery. And we're also going to remember the idiocracy of the people in this country who don't call it a great country, who don't believe in American exceptionalism. We're going to remember those people that when those over there fighting in Vietnam came home to obnoxious character on the behalf of many American citizens. I'll tell you, Dan, I'm going to say this, and then I'll pass it back to you. I'll pass it over to you. If I had my way, If I had my way, I would take every one of them still today that were obnoxious, and we would start out with Hanoi Jane, and I would take her to the public square. I would bend her over my knee. I would bare her butt, and I would take off my belt, and I would thoroughly and publicly humiliate her with a spanking in public. Because the behavior on behalf of some of the people as these troops came back from fighting that war was obnoxious. So with that, Dan, I will pass it to you, and our guest is waiting in the wings. He is there, so I will hand it to you and then let you introduce and bring our guest in.
Okay, that's great, and you're a lot nicer than me. I would have tarred and feathered her. I have no use for Hanoi Jane. I don't want to talk about her. She will never be forgiven. She broke the cardinal sin of this country. And for that, it's second, the only thing that's worse than murder. So for that being said, a lot of people really don't understand how we ended up in Vietnam. So I'd like to take a couple minutes and walk us through what led to our involvement in Southeast Asia. And this all began right at the end of World War II, as the Allied forces, England and America, came in from the West to take over Berlin. And as the communist forces under the leadership of Stalin came in from the East, and they met somewhere in the middle. And at the end of the war, people couldn't figure out which way they were going to go. The communists wanted all of Germany. Had that happened, communism would have spread throughout Europe, and we wouldn't have the same world that we're having today. So the U.S. refused to back down. The Russians responded by cutting off rail systems into West Germany, which essentially was cutting off their ability to get food and supplies. And we responded with the Berlin Airlift, which is an airlift that has been never seconded ever since. The amount of aircraft we had involved bringing in equipment and supplies to West Germany until we could build our own railroad systems. Well, after that, there was a real bad taste in most of Europe's mouth. And I think the French, because they had been defeated during World War II, wanted to be the first one to go out as a UN force into Southeast Asia. So in 1947, they sent in troops in hopes of stopping the communist expansion from the north. By that time, China had dropped its own democratic society that was, and their king and queen or whatever they called them back then, were exiled. And what gets me is that just after the rape of Nanking, we sent over a squadron that was later known under the command of Claire Chennault, later known as Flying Tigers, who protected China until we could get more forces in. And it was the United States who saved China during World War II, and their response was to turn their backs on us. The French had a real tough go of it in Southeast Asia. And in 1954, they suffered a terrible loss in Dien Bien Phu, where they lost miserably to the communists, who were being supported greatly by China. So the French were outnumbered. We had given been providing the tools of the trade by committing 80% of the cost of the war, but the French just couldn't match the numbers, and they were annihilated and elected to withdraw. Now, this is when we started sending in advisors. But that all changed all of a sudden in 1948 with Russia's having their first successful testing of the atomic bomb, and that was the beginning of the Cold War. So that kind of ramped up our desire to shut down the growth of communism. So we started sending more and more advisors under the Eisenhower administration. And let me back up a little bit. Under the Truman administration is where we took on the policy that we would do what we could to stop the communist expansion. And it started, our first in deployment was to Korea from in 1950. The war lasted until 1953, where we only managed to do a stalemate. And in the process, we lost 45,000 great Americans. And we found out that fighting a limited war was no way to fight, but the UN really wouldn't give us the freedom to fight a war as it should be. Then we had the construction of the Berlin Wall. We were not happy with the conflict in Korea, but we had hoped to change our things in Southeast Asia. But Kennedy and Eisenhower both knew the horrors of war. Both of them had been in World War II and served, and both of them knew what getting into a war meant. And had they, either one of them, decided to commit, it would not be under UN rules. It would have been all out because they knew they cannot fight a limited war. So in 1963, we could only speculate as to what Kennedy would do. We had November 22nd, 1963, President John F. Kennedy was assassinated. And he was replaced by Lyndon Baines Johnson, the person who never fought in a war, who never knew what the horrors of war was. And he really wanted to stop the expansion. McCarthyism in this country was going on full tilt, which I don't know, for those who don't know what McCarthyism was, is Eugene McCarthy started a witch hunt on suspected communists. Out of 1 in 10 people he accused and convicted of communism was an actual communist. The rest were, a lot of people were ruined because of him. But it also set the tone for us going into Vietnam. On the other side, we had a rapidly growing peace movement who wanted nothing to do with war. We had just gone through a World War II where we lost almost 500,000 Americans. Then we lost another 45,000 in Korea. So there was a group that really wasn't interested in getting involved in another war. Johnson understood this, so he needed an excuse. to get involved in Vietnam. And really none came by. So he created one that was later known as the Gulf of Tonkin Incident. And on August 2nd, allegedly a North Vietnamese patrol torpedo boat fired a torpedo at the USS Maddox. On the 4th, the USS Maddox also claimed another was fired upon them by North Korean patrol torpedo boats. Crew members later on testified that they never remember either incident. However, on August 7, 1964, the Gulf of Tonkin Resolution was passed, and this opened the door for Johnson to begin sending troops over to Southeast Asia. The draft was expanded to, as our numbers of troops included, began to grow. And by 1968, under command of General Westmoreland, we had a maximum of 535,000 men fighting in Vietnam. And by this time, Du Hau was already born, and from there, with that being said, I'd like to bring in our special guest host and a proud American and a veteran himself and somebody who grew up in the horrors of war. And I'd like, without further ado, Du Hau.
Hello there, Dan and Scott. Good afternoon, sir. How are you?
Oh, doing fantastic. How about you?
I want to take this opportunity. It's Memorial Weekend. I really like to take a few moments to remember our men and women. So it's more than 58,000 American lives. Hundreds of thousands got wounded in the war in Vietnam. Still, the thousands still missing in actions, and also we want to acknowledge the brutality, how our prisoner of war got treated by the communists of Vietnam, and also wanted to take this opportunity to remember the South Vietnamese Armed Force. There's over 300,000 South Vietnamese Armed Forces have paid their ultimate sacrifice also. Millions got wounded, and the people of South Vietnam in this misery of their life. After the fall of Saigon, more than a million of Vietnamese got escaped the communists. More than half got died, either in the ocean or in the jungle. A thousand got lucky escape to the freedom, but somehow thousands still sent back to the communist of Vietnam in the early 1990s. So for all these said, I would really appreciate what we have here today. We are live for those who die for us, who fought for us for freedom. So I really wanted to invite you and me and the people, our people here in America, to acknowledge and appreciate the life that we have here in America. And thank you so much.
Well, thank you, Du Hau. Yes, we... and both sides paid so many sacrifices in order for a good cause that was unfortunately by the press made to look like a catastrophe. And it was our press really never told the true story of all the good things that our soldiers did. And
yes.
To all our American veterans who returned to Vietnam, to the United States after serving gallantly in Southeast Asia, I'd like to pay a tribute, and on behalf of Contributing for Truth Radio, I would like to send a real thank you out, and I want to welcome you all home, and I wish I could shake each and every one of your hands. What you
yes.
did was not in vain.
Yes.
We just weren't allowed to finish the job. And,
right.
You know, it's terrible when they realize the people of the United States turn their backs to the 2 million people who were killed because of our pulling out of Vietnam. They pretend like nothing else happened. And that's not the truth. I mean, it's horrible. I feel terrible every day for that. But it was a war fought in Washington and not on the ground.
That's
where
right.
decisions should have been made. And had we committed our forces, I had explained in a post the other day how all we had to do was go along the coast, push the north up to the DMZ, where we had the narrowest point in Vietnam, and then we just needed to go sector by sector. And after we took every sector, we would secure it with armed forces, and we could have won the war.
Right.
You know, it wasn't an unwinnable war. It was a very winnable war. Armed troops, see, if you cut off the access from the north, you cut off all their tools of the trade. You could have shut down everything, and they could not wage war. And it was unlike Korea, which was a wider and more difficult terrain, and they had much more difficult conditions with the winters, you know, where it was 44 below zero, and, you know, at least in Vietnam, you never froze to death. that was one good thing. But had we just shut off the access to the north, had we bombed the harbor in Hanoi that the Russians and Chinese said they would enter the war, which they already were, but they wouldn't have escalated because they knew that they'd be getting into something they didn't want to get into. So had we, that was an idle threat as far as I'm concerned. Had we bombed the ports and had we bombed the trade routes, we could have shut down access for them to continue fighting. And we should have really ended the war rapidly. But politics, unfortunately, did not allow that. And your earliest memories as a very young child, did you see a lot of Arvin and American forces or more NVA or Viet Cong?
As a young child there, during those years, I remember very well that I get to meet the Americans and the Arvins every day. And also the sad news around our village every single day. I remember that one of the family in my village, they were still a beautiful young couple. Her husband was a soldier, a very good soldier, and I believe he is like some sort of like a special force for the South Vietnamese. And he was an officer, and He shot a hero. I remember I saw him in uniform, and every time he came home to his wife and his kids and his family, they are so beautiful and so proud of just a soldier the way he was. But one day I remember the sad news that broke out from the wife and the family. He got killed in the battle. It just sad everything, almost every single day we get her sad news. But I got to meet I saw a lot of, my brothers and my brother-in-law was in the South Vietnamese Armed Force. And I got to meet the American go up and down the freeway one every single day. And I got to meet them. I got a lot of time. The American soldiers, they are usually, they love the kids and they just want to talk with them and they give them candies and stuff like that. I remember I got candy from American soldiers there. So I tell you what, I many times when I'm trying to give people messages, because the nature of ours, our soldier came back from Vietnam and got treated the way it shouldn't be. That's why I keep telling them. I could tell them that, thank you on all our Vietnam veterans who have gives love and their compassion for the people of South Vietnam, especially the children. And I remember, and I want to tell that to every single one of them. They are the people that give freedom for the people of South Vietnam. So, yes, I have a lot of interaction when I was a kid with them, both sides, the South Vietnamese soldiers and the Americans. When you mentioned earlier about the nature of South Korea and Vietnam. Yeah. I wanted to say again, I would like really our listeners to understand that the purpose and the goal that we have trying to give it to South Korea, and that's the same goal and purpose. The American people wanted to do it, to give it to Vietnam, to South Vietnam. However, the South Korea now they become a brilliant South Korea with brilliant freedom and democracy. Look what they are today. They one of the top the people there. They enjoy their life and their technology and their peace, and obviously they still under threat of North Korea. But I know that the Americans have got the purpose of that we give it to them. But look at South Vietnam. South Vietnam was in the 60s. We knew that the South Vietnamese was really strong, brave, and intelligent and smart. They built their, they're not only trying to defend it from the north, but they also built South Vietnam to one of the leading country in Southeast Asia at that time. But look what happened. And it's just so sad that the nature and the fate of the country had come to the 1975, and look what they are today. It's just still struggling under corruptions, under sufferings. So to so many poor, poor people of Vietnam.
You know, Dr. Durant, I'm glad you went into that. I'm glad you asked that question, Dan. You know, I've got my three nieces sitting here. One is 12, one is 8, and one is 5. And we're going to study the Vietnam War next week. I'm homeschooling the oldest and the youngest, and we've been doing. My oldest has gotten actually 2 years worth of high school history lessons in the last 6 months. And we're going to study the Vietnam War. That's what's next for Memorial Day week. But number one, they want to say hi.
Thank you.
And for my next question, you know, I know you speak to students a lot. You speak in the high schools. You speak in the middle schools. And I'd like to, you know, they've been born and raised in this great country, and I'm going to do this without crying. But we're so spoiled, Dr. Du. We're so spoiled. And it's one of our problems is we've got everything so easy. We go to the refrigerator, and we pull out what we want, and then we complain about it because we want something else. But there's so many young kids over the years, and right now in different countries of the world, that don't have that much. You didn't in Vietnam. You didn't just go to the refrigerator and decide, do I want hot dogs or hamburgers today? And you watched some horrific things as children. These kids have never even been through a war. They don't even understand what a war would all be about. So I'd like for you to talk like you would talk to the high school group or the middle school group or an elementary school and kind of share some of the experiences and share some of the words of wisdom that you would share with young students.
Yes, well, I have been talking up to a lot of students. And I do believe that they are the future of our country. So the more students I talk to, you know, the better I feel. And to love about our nation here, but every time I keep emphasizing what they are here today, how the way we live here, it did not just come out of nowhere. Somebody have created it. Somebody have given their life. Somebody have protect their freedom and democracy, so they can have the life that they have here in America. So I couldn't go enough. Many times I give them a story of my when I was a very small child during those years in under the war. We got shot, even though we were a child, we got shot, many children saw their parents got killed or their brother and their family got killed. It just every single day, and I tell you the truth. During those years, I don't have I hardly have a shoe to walk. As I walk bare feet, we're so poor because my parents lost their home in the original land that we have. We lost everything. It's just every single day is just a struggle day for us there under the war. So I like to emphasize all that. And I especially our children, to understand how valuable, how precious we have here is freedom, and to understand and to think about where all these things come from. So that's what I'm trying to do.
Well, and I thank you for that, because we have a lot of discussions, and I've shown them YouTube videos of children in foreign lands who have to go and they have to walk and carry water in buckets. We go and we turn on the spigot, and if the hot water heater's not working, we call somebody real quick because we can't do without that. And we have so many fine things, and it's a wonderful thing. That's why we love this great country, is the standard of living that we live in. But it hasn't been that way for most of the children of the world. Many children in many war-torn nations have watched the horrors of war. Even in the United States of America during World War I and World War II, which we would say it's a world war. But as far as the United States went, you know, we had some blackouts. Some people in Hawaii saw some pretty horrific things. But in mainland United States of America, we didn't see the horrors of war. Our young men did abroad. They went over and saw the horrors of war and lost their lives. But we've lived so many years in this great country with so many wonderful things. And I think it's important, especially as we're celebrating this on Memorial Day, and a lot of you, our listeners, we want to talk to you for a moment. A lot of our listeners, you're listening to this on Memorial Day, because we're going to put the link out for this particular show on Memorial Day and use this as our Memorial Day broadcast to remember and continue to remember the freedom that we fight for, and the freedom that some many, many people in the world don't have, and the freedom that you left Vietnam for. And I want to kind of, you know, we did this already last Tuesday. We had you on as a guest. Not very often we do a guest twice in 1 week. But Dan and I felt it really important to get your story out again, as well as to get it out on this particular show, because our theme for this show has been there and done that. And we study a lot of history. So if you could, I'd like you again to just kind of give us a quick rundown from beginning to end. You were in Vietnam, you saw that as a child, the war ended, you were oppressed by the communists, you fled Vietnam, it was not an easy thing to get here to the United States. Once you did, you got here and you jumped some huge hurdles, and have become a great American success story. So if I can have you one more time go through that quick bio of yours, and then I'll pass it back to Dan, and then we also want to, at some point, Dan, we'll mention the book after that.
Sure, I'd be glad to. I was born in the early 60s, and I was born in the war zone, right where the country bombarded with battles and killings and destruction and all that. But our thing is 1965. My parents' original village got evacuated, so they had to move to a more secure village, which is that they had to give up everything: their land, their rice paddies, and everything, big house, and all that. So basically, I didn't get to enjoy the fortune from my parents at all. So when I was just a toddler, I started recognize the war. I started seeing all that stuff. And like I said, during those time, I seeing the Americans and the South Vietnamese soldiers there. And then one day, my brother, I mentioned that he was in the South Vietnamese Armed Force, and he got injured. And my mother took me with her to visit him in the hospital. And good thing he didn't get killed. So it just somehow at that moment in time, I just start thinking about I just love my brother so much, and I just wanted to be with him. And I start thinking about what do I need to do? So I wanted to become a soldier then, even though I was just a little child, to fight the communists. And then things go along. Then I keep witnessing all these horrible and terrible. My friend's father got killed. My entire family got bombarded with RPG. And the entire family, except the mother, got killed. It's just every single day is a drama in my village and in my neighbors. So, and then, oh my God, the fall of Saigon. At that time, we lived in the middle of Vietnam, and the province called Quang Ngai, which is about about a few hours south of Da Nang. And I remember that the last of the province Quang Ngai were before the fall of Saigon, which is the April 30th of 1975. When the NVA invaded Quang Ngai, I remember that day. I remember vividly. I saw their tanks moving in. I saw the Viet Cong was side by side with the tank and with their gun in the hand, with their eyes get ready to get killed. And I was so scared. And I remember that day how we lost Quang Ngai before we lost Da Nang and Saigon. So it's just all the bad images in me at that time. But I was about 12, 13 years old at that time. So I lost my school, and then the fall of Da Nang and the fall of Saigon, we totally lost our country. I remember those days in between. I have my sisters live in Vung Tau, which is about an hour from Saigon. And I remember that, and also my mother's, my parents was thinking about my brother-in-law and my brother who was still in the South Vietnamese Armed Force. They cry days after day and wondering where were they and did they get killed or whatsoever. Those days are just in really the whole family was in darkness. So and then the fall of Saigon, we finally got forced. They forced us to the countryside, go back to wild land. They took whatever business that my mother had. We don't have anything left. We just scavenger all the materials that we have for the small village to the wild land, and just we have to do what we need to do to survive one day at a time. And many times we just go and get the greens on the field, whatever it is, we can eat. We eat it. And then, but my mother worked extremely hard. She eventually created a very small business and have our family going. And then, you know, I was just a teenager, and my mother wanted me to get some education. But no, because of our background, the local communists on my village there don't allow me. They didn't allow me to go to school. And then finally, we got the news that my brother had to he just escaped from Vung Tau, which is close to Saigon. I at that point in time, I was just a child. I have no idea what escaped, why that people had to leave Vietnam. Because I have no idea there's another world besides communism. But then, after that news that my brother had escaped Vietnam, I started thinking, wow, there's a way. And then, even though a child, I got a will, along with my parents and my family. I started instead of escape in Quang Ai, which is 100 times harder. And if they even get caught in Quang Ai, I'm sure they could kill me instantly. But that's why my parents wanted me to move to Vung Tau, which is to the south, close to Saigon, and escape there. And 11 times, thank God, I didn't get caught, get killed, or get captured by the communists, and eventually got out, escaped out of Vietnam, and I got lucky, got rescued by the German ship. Otherwise, I tell you what, did one hurdle after the others, one desperation after the others. It's just the hopelessness always in front of us. And after 5 days and nights in the ocean, we thought we know where that we would get anywhere. Thank Lord, the Cap Anamur, which is the name of the ship of German ship, rescued us in the brutal water of that day, I remember. So, oh my God, I got to step up to that big ship. I know my life was saved. I know the life of people on our little boat was saved. That nothing valuable. Nothing. I feel so good that God have loved us. And then, but after I got rescued, and then we got dropped off in the refugee camp in the Philippines. Even though so, not an easy life in the refugee camp. But as soon as we just got out of the community of Vietnam, We happy. We was rather die than live with the communist of Vietnam. And that's why even though so we live in a tiny refugee camp, the thousands of people concentrated, we barely get by with little rice, little fish, but got by every day and got the help with our family member who was already escaped and live in abroad. I remember those days in refugee camp. But I managed to finally get to this country, and then, but another hurdle. Now, I got the opportunity, I got the chance to live my life that other people had died for me, but I don't want to live just like to live every single day. I have somehow, just somewhere, I started have my goal and purpose. Just a few years after walking to the church to learn ESLs, to trying to get my GED certificate, and then get a ride with my friend to college. It's just unbelievable. And I get a job at $3 an hour in a laundromat. I do it all. I did it all. I went there, and then until one day I realized that I love serving my country. But now the America, the United States of America, have become my new motherland here. So I wanted to serve. And one night I get up. Somehow my conscience tell me, let's join U.S. Navy. My brother didn't really happy. That time I lived with my brother. My brother wasn't happy with me on that idea because he know how hard it was. He was a soldier. But beside the point, the language barrier, the societies, the new societies, the new custom that we have go through with this a new country that we live in. But I told him, I determined. I know it's going to be tough. I know it's going to be very hard. But I asked him just to give me a chance to do what I wanted to do. And he did. And I remember, he right very hard. As a man, as a young man who barely speak English, and went to boot camp in the Navy, I remember it's tough, but somehow I get through. I remember I still have to learn extra English curriculum in boot camp, so I could pass my reading level in English. I remember that, but I take it. I was happy. I said, oh, wow, I have another chance to learn more English here in boot camp. So it doesn't matter what it takes. I did it all. I went through, and I passed it, and I went through, and I finally belong one of my sailor on my very, good squadron. It's called VFA 86. That's the F-18 Hornets. We was the F-18 squadron, and I become one of their mechanic, maintain the F-404 F-18 engines. So I was so proud. And by the way, I just want you to share this with you also. The day that I graduated from boot camp in the U.S. Navy, it stung. Even though I don't have any family member around, my mother, my parents were still in Vietnam. And up that day, I remember, I thought of my parents a lot. And it just stung that I have an opportunity to follow my belief. And I know that they were so proud of me, even though they're not there. I went on and served my country in that aircraft carrier, CV-66, USS America. I remember I served a few crews. The first cruise was the NATO cruise. We went to the North Atlantic Ocean. And then the second cruise, we went for over 6 months in the Mediterranean Sea. I remember the day that we came back. We done our job, we came back. I remember the day that our ship hit the port in Norfolk, Virginia. I saw my shipmates, family and friends, wife and husband, and brother and sister there was trying to catch them off the ship. But me, I look up above, and thinking of my family back in Vietnam. And even though I had nobody there, but it's so painful that I have served the cruise totally and came back and proud being a sailor in our great nations. I couldn't proud more on that day. And then, you know what? A few years later, I got injured. I was dreamed to become a F-18 pilot. The pilots I serve in the aircraft carrier, they aspire for me so much. I dreamed to become one. But my injury prevented me to become one. But you know what? I become a pharmacist instead of become a pilot. I continue serving my nations and serving my community. Every time I saw my patients, especially my Vietnam veterans, I saw anyone about in the 50s or 60s, and especially those who wear the hat, Vietnam veterans, I left my computers. I went to the front of the counters, and I said, "You must be a Vietnam veteran, and thank you. Thank you for serving in the norms." I shake their hand. I look in their eyes. So, and then, even now, I would trying to convey my message more, not even to the veteran, to the people. The people of the United States of America, to let them know that our Vietnam veterans was heroes. They are heroes. They shouldn't be treated the way they should be. That's why I wrote the book. I wrote them the book to let them know that how much we suffer through the war, and especially through the communism. But I want to let them know that our Vietnam veteran wanted to finish the job that they did to South Korea, but they didn't let them. The politician didn't let them finish the job. And even today, many times, even in the Facebook or meeting them in the real life and in our community, many of them, they said they would. Even though with their health and their age, they would go back instantly and go back to Vietnam and fight the communists today. That's how much I love my Vietnam veterans. So I keep going with my purpose. I consider the rest of my life. I need to get my work out as much as I can to praise our men and women. Not just our Vietnam veterans. They're out there to fight for our belief, to fight for our freedom and democracy. And that's why I wrote the book. And even today, I wanted, especially this memorial today, I want them to know that our Vietnam veterans and all veterans are our heroes. And we thinking of them every single day, every single moment, for their service and their sacrifice, so that all Americans will live here at home and enjoy their life and sleep well at night. I thank you them so much, and thank you for listening.
Well, you are welcome. Because it's people like you who make this nation so great. And I'd like to let you know that many of our listeners are Vietnam veterans. And to all of you out there who served over there, welcome home. And we are very, very proud of your sacrifices, and don't think ever that those people who treated you badly represent the average person, because we love each and every one of you. I consider you all heroes, and you'll always be number one on my knit list. I share very much the same feelings, though I can't imagine from your perspective what you went through. But I know families who lost, you know, brothers, because I graduated, I was in high school in 1975 at the end of the war, so I was getting pretty close to the age where I'd be serving, and I knew brothers and sisters who didn't show up. I have a friend of mine who was like you, he was career military. He was a major at the time with the U.S. Marine Corps Construction Battalion team. And
wow.
he got wounded 6 times in one day to the point where he will not show his legs because the injuries, you know, were the scars so bad. And then he came home and they spit on him. And that just tears my heart apart. I still can't go up to the memorial in Washington. I start crying like a baby just thinking about it. The first time I went there, I went down, and you can feel the sorrow as you walk up to the wall. And it just cuts me to the heart. And on my end, I remember every night watching on the TV as the names went by in the background of the KIAs and the MIAs, and seeing how many families. Back then, we used to have flags out. If you had a son serving, it was a blue star. It was a silver star if they were MIA, and a gold star if they were KIA. And to see those gold stars, really bother me. And, you know, especially to a country that didn't appreciate their sacrifices. And that's why I shake my hand to every vet I see to this day. It's very, very important to me. You know, going through my fiance, her brother, her husband was in Vietnam, and the nightmares he had. He died of a heart attack right before Barb and I met, and right after Barb and I met, and right before, I mean, I don't get it. He was a flight mechanic on a Chinook. And what province was he in? He was in Ben Juan and Fuloy.
Oh wow,
sure,
Ben Juan.
Yeah, and. You know, he had nightmares to the day he died.
Wow.
You know, what he went through. And I had another friend, a very good friend I used to race sailboats with, who was a helicopter pilot on a Huey. and he was medevac. He was a medevac pilot, and you know what they went through. They would go into LZs no matter what. You know, they'd have enemies shooting at them from all sides. And these brave pilots went in to bring out our wounded troops. And he was telling me SAM was fired at them just as they took off. And it blew up under the helicopter. And
wow.
A charge of shrapnel went up and hit him in the rear end and came out in his lower back. He was another one of what I call the walking wounded, because he too, when he returned, was treated like garbage. And you know, it's I can never forgive those people. I really can't. They did what they did to our returning soldiers. It was fine to go against the war, but to blame the GI and call them baby killers.
Right.
When in fact, you know, they were doing just the opposite. They were trying to save the children. And to these people and the people at Hanoi Jane,
yes.
As far as I'm concerned to this day, you know, may she rot in hell.
Exactly right.
I can never forgive that. That was something that, to me, was treason. I mean, that's all it was. It was high treason. And,
yes.
You know, I heard in your voice cracking, and you can ask Scott. That's a regular one for me. I get teary-eyed and, just because, you know, I knew a lot of these people, and I saw the scars. What I call the walking wounded to this day, how it still bothers them. You know, they can't even live a normal life to this day because of less, you know,
right.
The fighting was terrible. But it's how they were treated that really sent the scars. And it wasn't their fault. It was the fault of our government. And, you know, this is why we do this show, is
yes.
to show the world that, you know, for one thing, if you're going to fight a war, you don't go in there and fight over a piece of ground to give it right back to the enemy. You don't fight a war without the intention of winning. And unlike Korea, we went into Vietnam with no intention of winning. And that's what bothers me. It was... all I can say on behalf of our nation is that it was a very rough time, and we lost, you know, we lost Dr. Martin Luther King, we lost Robert F. Kennedy, and we lost John F. Kennedy to assassinations. There was a group of people who just did not know. And they argued against a war they did not understand. And I'm not trying to give them excuses. But I hope that through your story, and maybe they'll take a second look at what's going on in Afghanistan and Iraq and see that until you get the job done, you can't just walk away.
That's right. And Lee, let me also want to say something here just for our listener to understand. The way I know, even the last few years, I mean, do a lot of research about the war and stuff like that. But just people don't understand that during those years under the war, we are not just fighting the North Vietnamese. We're not just fighting that. We're fighting the spreading of communism. We're fighting the spread of Red China and Russia. But we're not really fighting the North Vietnamese at that time. We were there. It's just the place for us to show the world. But behind that is the Chinese and the Russia. So if people understand that, then they'll probably come into different perspective and about what our belief and our goal and purpose now.
Yeah, I mean, we were definitely, matter of fact, the first MiG pilots that were shot down were Chinese.
Oh,
they were
yes.
Of the Chinese Air Force. And we also shot the first MiG-22, which was a Russian pilot.
Wow.
And, yeah, so we knew that Russians and Chinese were both participating in the war.
Right.
And, you know, that we needed more resources. And we needed our commanders to be on the ground, not sitting there at some desk in Washington, D.C., making the decisions and saying, oh, no, we can't cross that line. We'll get somebody else mad at us. Lines don't exist in war. You know, all the North Vietnamese needed to do was step over a line, then they would stick their tongues out at us.
Mm-hmm.
And there was nothing we could do. And that's no way to fight a war. And to this day, you know, it breaks my heart to know how our veterans were treated. These were brave young men that, you know, one week, a friend of mine's brother came home 2 weeks before the 4th of July. And every time a firework would go off, he'd be jumping into a ditch.
Whoa.
Well,
wow.
And just, you know, kind of, you know, you just got out of the war zone a few weeks ago. And, of course, anytime you hear an explosion, you think it's fire, enemy fire. So he took cover. And, you know, it's – I wanted to fight because I wanted to show, as a proud American – you know, Scott and I talk a lot about history, and we talk about the Declaration of Independence when we first declared our independence from the British, that 3/4 of the signers of the Declaration of Independence lost everything to create this nation. 5 of them were killed in action. But this built strength in our country. It built the belief that freedom is everybody's business.
Right.
And that if we are to obtain that freedom and to keep that freedom, we must be willing to sacrifice everything. And
yes, sir.
To this day, like the rest of the Vietnam vets, You know, I'm sitting here on the heart transplant list, and but if my country called me, or I knew I had to protect our town or our village or, you know, the retirement community I live in, I have my Colt 45, and I'll be out there.
I have, yes.
You know, I have 500 rounds sitting in my closet. And,
all right.
I may not be going very fast, but... But, you know, that's my attitude, is that being a patriot requires more than just words.
Oh, definitely.
You know,
Dan, I want to throw in here. I'm getting a little echo. I hope that's not broadcasting through. But I do want to throw in here the escapes in my journey. You know, Dr. Dew, you one of the hurdles that you jumped over is a huge hurdle, as you spoke about last week. And I want to throw the book out there, and then I'll let you talk about it and some of the reasons why you wrote the book. But The Escapes and My Journey to Freedom. And the title, I think, encompasses why we're doing this show. You know, we talk a lot about Cuba on this show. I always say, Dr. Dew, if you're having a discussion with a liberal, there's only two questions that you really need to ask them. In the shark-infested waters down there south of you at the tip of Florida, between Florida and Cuba, which way are the people swimming? And when the Berlin Wall fell, which way did the people run? Did they run from the east to the west, or did they run from the west to the east? And I think that should tell you all you really need to know about communism, socialism. They're all, I know they're different. The liberals would argue with me and say they're not the same thing. I know there's differences. But basically the foundation is the same. It ends up in tyranny. It ends up in a lack of freedom. It ends up in bondage. Your story is one of going from slavery, basically, to freedom. We talk a lot about Frederick Douglass on this show. Frederick Douglass, a young slave boy, learned how to read. And in learning how to read, became a great, great man, a great author, had the ear of presidents, and succeeded in life and jumped hurdles like nobody would believe. You jumped some great hurdles. You retell your story. You were asked to retell your story. You wrote a book. It wasn't easy for you to do because English is not your first language. That was not what you didn't grow up in school learning what the eight parts of the English language like we do here. You had to come over and do that as an adult. I'm a teacher. I homeschool. I taught junior high in the 90s. I know how difficult it is to learn the older you get. As a five-year-old, my youngest niece can tell you all the states and capitals, and she's 5 years old. She could read by the time she was almost 4 years old. It's easy as a young child. As you become an adult, it's not easy to do. It was a big, huge hurdle. And
right.
I want to encourage everybody, go to Facebook, and you can find his book, The Escapes and My Journey to Freedom. Just type that into your search box, The Escapes. And with the ampersand sign, My Journey to Freedom. We'll post the information on the Contending for Truth radio page as well. And tell us exactly how we can get your book, how long it took you to write this book, how you were encouraged to get the book, and so on and so forth. I do also want to say, Dan, I am getting ready to get in the car. We have got a Memorial Day party to go to. I will still be here on the radio. I will be broadcasting live from the car via phone. One of the nice things about Blog Talk Radio, you know, Dan, you and I have broadcast this show when I've been sitting at International House of Pancakes. It's a great thing that we can do. So I will still be here, but I am going to be in the car, so I'm going to let you and Dr. Dew take the majority of the rest of the show to talk. I won't have the studio right there, possibly, by the time we get over there, so I'm not sure if we'll have have any concluding music or not. But we can go ahead. And Dan, and let me tell you, there's a lot to talk about if you want to go past that top hour mark. I want to let our listeners know, if you're listening and we go past that second hour, we can go into a third hour, but you won't be able to hear it on the Internet this time around. They'll hear it just fine in the archive. But if you want to hear, if we go past the next 40 minutes, call in at 347-205-9620 before we get to the end, and you can continue to listen on the phone. But I want to pass it back to you, Dr. Dew, to talk about your book a little bit. And let everybody know how they can buy the book. Of course, we'll send them to the Facebook page. And then after that, Dan, I'll just let you take it over, and I will probably be in the car, and I'll just pop in when I get settled in enough that I can pop in.
Thank you very much, Scott.
Okay, Duhau. Yeah, could you explain your book and how you began to start writing it, and
I have the company called Author House. The website called www.authorhouse.com. That is the company that helped me to make the book. However, you can anybody can go into Amazon or basically any bookstore online. Can search for either my name, Duhua, or just the name of the book, The Escapes and My Journey to Freedom. They can find out and how to order it. Also, I would also, if anybody wanted to contact me with an autograph, or I also have some copies here, I can send them. I'm also more than willing to do that for our friends and our patriots here in our country. I do all I can to have the book have the book to the people to read my message.
Well, I'd like to drive down there and meet you personally.
Where do you live?
I live out just north of Tampa. And,
that's not too far.
Yeah, if you're ever up this way or I'm down that way, I'll definitely give you a call and we can get together. And I live less than a tenth of a mile from a VFW. So
wow.
I'm over there all the time, and I have a lot of Vietnam friends, who fought over there. And I do have one little funny story is when I was putting myself through flight school, I was working for Signature Flight Support, and an FA-18, a pair of FA-18s landed. And the guy was trying to tell me how to get the ladder down, you know, that little latch underneath the wing, right by the wing root. You push and, you know, the ladder folds down. I couldn't find the little switch. It was 15 minutes I'm looking underneath where finally found it. You know, the poor pilot was stuck up in the cockpit, you know. But, I've touched and fueled an FA-18. Obviously I've never flown one. And I was told even early on, a friend of mine was an F-4 pilot, and then transitioned over to the F-16 with the 107th Air Guard up near Niagara Falls. And I have another friend that he fought in Vietnam, flew F-4s, and then transitioned to the F-14. And, So, you know, when you speak to military people, most of my friends are. The only reason I didn't go into the military is right after high school, I went right into college because my father was a professor. And after I got out of college, they wanted me to go directly into working with Raytheon. And, you know, I worked on the on some projects there and found out I wasn't a very good programmer and went on my way. And from then on in, I sailed professionally. My story's a little varied, but it's nowhere near what the hurdles that you had to jump. Mine were just me being an adventurer, I guess, for lack of any other words. But it never, ever since I was born up in the Northeast, up not far away. I lived not too far away from Walden's Pond, where Henry David Thoreau lived. And I've been to the Wayside Inn, where Longfellow wrote The Midnight Ride of Paul Revere. I've been and I've seen John Hancock's grave, Paul Revere's grave, the parents of Benjamin Franklin, where they lay. I've been to the Boston Master. Been on the oldest commissioned ship in the U.S. Navy, the USS Constitution, and called Old Ironside. History has always been a deep thing in my heart, and because I believe that history repeats itself. And I explained, in the paper I wrote for you, I said I saw way back in 69, I saw the examples of the Battle of the Bulge to the Tet Offensive. And I knew it was an all-out, all-or-nothing type attack.
Right.
Had we initiated a massive, aggressive attack, the North Vietnamese would have nothing to stop us because they had spent everything they could on the Tet, and they didn't have the ability to continue waging war. They spoke of the Ho Chi Minh Trail, and if you think about it, in the wages of war, how much can we carry down by people? Not much.
Mm-hmm.
We could have won that war very easily. The only problem we had was identifying the enemy, but we had Arvin troops that could do that.
Mm-hmm.
So even the language barrier really wasn't a problem to us. And, this is why I'm so angry at our politicians and how they went into Vietnam, because and how they looked the other way afterwards. And this is the thing that, we've had Enrique, who was in Cuba during the fall of Cuba when Castro took over. And he was a bit older than you and watched his family lose everything. And next week we're going to have on our show somebody who escaped from Russia and can talk from the Russian communists. So it's great to have people from all over the world to show them that communism is the same no matter where you go. And
mm-hmm.
all it is oppression, and how it doesn't, you know, it doesn't give you the freedom to achieve the goals that you want. And that really bothers me. You know, and your story is so important that people hear. And I heard it in your voice how much it still affects you. And I could only imagine seeing my country fall. A nation you grew up in that you loved with all your heart, being taken away. My ex-sister-in-law talks of Saigon and the history of the city and how beautiful it used to be. It was, she has photographs that I saw, and Saigon was truly, it was really only second to Singapore. You know, it was one of the two major hubs in, in the trade industry. It was rapidly, had we won the war, I have no doubt in my mind that it would be in the same position as Seoul, South Korea, and Singapore as a major, place of research and development, and it wouldn't be an entirely different place. Mm-hmm. It would be, today it's people don't even have cars. They ride around on bicycles. They're a third world nation now, all because of communism. And, tell me your feelings as you left Vietnam for the last time. How was it to lose, to watch your country fade off into the sunset? That must have been so difficult.
Yes. I remember the year that I was trying to escape. The one thing about me is I didn't escape and succeeded right away, so escape after escapes. But especially the few of the first escapes, I kept thinking, I know that There's nothing I could do there, and just there's no hope for the young generation there. They have managed somehow, some way, they took over the South, and just there's no idea that for the people to raise. Rise back and take what we shouldn't be taken away, but I have very mixed feeling. I thought that we shouldn't be escaping my own country. I shouldn't be leaving my parents behind. It's just a lot of mixed feeling. But one thing for sure that I know that what I need to do to go on with my life, because if I stay back, there's no hope for me or for anybody after all. Many times I got very discouraged because many of my escapes didn't really made it out. So I was kind of like hopeless and say, okay, what do I do now? Should I just go on and keep trying to fight away, or what do I need to do now? But the bottom line, after many nights of thinking and figure it out. I said, I would rather, whatever happened to me, I'd rather get killed. They can shoot me or they can, what the outcome would be. But I had to keep doing my escapes. And it's just a horrible feeling for people who had to leave their family behind. There are people behind, there are village behind, everything. It's not an easy feeling at all. I don't wish this to anybody at all. We are now in the 21st century. We should use our humanity, the courtesy of the talks. The understandings and the way to work it out for so people wouldn't be suffering this much at in the back all those years, and that's what I'm thinking. But it doesn't happen that way at all. Today, I try to follow the news in Vietnam every single day. But I can see is just like people around the world, like in the Middle East and Libya and the Egypt and other countries, people starting taking their power back. They're trying to asking for their freedom and human rights back. So I see something like that happening in Vietnam at this time. But I don't know when it will happen. Under the communist country, it's much, much, much harder, especially the Vietnam were next to the China. So, and also there's another thing that we most don't understand. There's the communist of Vietnam regime plus the communists of the Chinese regime. You don't know what they say and what they do in the back door. Even though right now, as you can see, is that the communist China were trying to invade the Vietnam. They were trying to do a lot of bad things in Vietnam right now, and almost I can tell you, there are even towns and cities, all Chinese there, because the way the agreement between the Communist China and the Communist Vietnam, even though the people there, whenever they have their opinions, and they want to have their freedom to speak out because it's not right for them, and they are always under the oppression of the Communist Vietnam. There's always under the eyes the surveillance of the people of Vietnam. So it's just a sad news every single day still until today.
Yeah, and it would be very difficult today to be able to go in there and find out who the enemy was and who wasn't, especially with the invasion of so many Chinese people. It would be very, very difficult to say who was, a Democratic supporter or who wouldn't be. And I'm not sure how that's going to eventually, end up, because unless the village people are willing to point out and risk their lives and who was the enemy, I don't know how the heck we'd do it. We had enough trouble back in the day. Today it would be 10 times worse. And, I'm not sure exactly how unless the Arvin Army could somehow rebuild itself behind the scenes, where they could tell us, and help us. find those who we needed to remove. That'd be a very, very difficult task. It's like kind of going through a bag of marbles and trying to find out, you know, which marbles belong and which marbles don't. I mean, it's it would be a very, very difficult task. And, you know, I'm not sure how it could be done without liberating the entire country and, you know, and trying to re-educate everybody.
Right.
You know, and that would be a difficult thing. And I think it could be done, but there'd be a lot of fighting for a long time before they were willing to relinquish, you know, their former beliefs. And, you know, it's a problem we have when the USSR fell and Russia became free.
Right.
They wanted their freedom, but they didn't understand how to use it.
That's right.
And, you know, it's without taking control and creating a police state until you can educate them, it's about the only way you can do it. You know, is to, just like a child, you'd have to start, you know, teaching them what it is to be free. Because they've always been, you know, taken care of and told what to do by the state.
Right.
And that'd be a real difficult task. For you, after you left Vietnam, were you ever able to talk, communicate with your parents? Or?
Yes. During the early years, very difficult, but then the relationship between America and Vietnam getting more slack, and especially the Communist Vietnam were trying to do business with other people so they can get money, income for their country. But the thing about me is my father passed away when I was in the Navy. So there's no way, during those years, there's no way I could go back to see him for the last time. Or and besides the point that I was in the U.S. Navy. But so I still have my mother left. When I got out of the Navy and become a pharmacist, she's still there, even though very old and very weak. So I decided just to go back to visit her. For the last time, and because I don't know that when I would lose her. So 2004 and 2005, I did go back and went visit her, and I will be able to show her my love and my support and my, you know, and how much I miss her. And then one time in 2006, I believe she passed away, and so I went back for the last time to attend her funeral, and that was it. And I don't have I would never want to go back.
So you have no family left over there, so.
I do have sisters. I'm sister there, but you know, and they can manage themselves. But the people that I really care the most are my parents, and they're not there anymore. So. And besides, the Communists of Vietnam was getting more intense in corruption and oppressing the people. I just don't want to go there anymore. Unless if I could go back and fight, I can go tomorrow.
I know the feeling. I mean, yeah, the patriot never dies.
Right.
even, you know, at our age, because I'm assuming, what year were you born?
1961.
Yeah, see, we're only a few years apart. I was born in 59, so... Yeah, so we're only a few years apart, and even in our old age, it'd be like, you know, give me a weapon, and I'll be out there. I may not go fast, but... you know, I went out this past year and bought a Colt 45 model 1911. That was the standard service revolver. I'm sure you saw thousands of when you were living in Vietnam.
Yes.
You know, that was the pistol that they had. And I intentionally purchased that because of the history. It goes back to the Spanish-American War and was used in every war right up to Afghanistan. The Navy SEALs still use them. So it's you know, a proud historical weapon. And I have it sitting about 2 feet away from me right now. And, you know, it's a it was a I had the purchase was a show of solidarity for our Second Amendment for me. It was, you know, to say that, no, our government is not going to take away my right to own a firearm. And, you know, we fight this show for a number of reasons, you know. I'm sure you saw on the front of my webpage the picture of Ronald Reagan.
Right.
And it says freedoms, everybody is no more than a generation away from being lost. And it is so true. And we're seeing that right now.
Right.
You know, we have a socialist president who was doing his best to take away our rights, and it is time the people need to stand up and speak out against us because they don't know what they're doing. And it's through sharing your story where you can say, yeah, I know what it's like on the other side. You know, and that's so very, very important.
Yes.
Because the people don't understand that the path we're on,
right.
You know, once we lose freedom, we'll never, it'll be very difficult.
Exactly right. See, the main problem is people don't realize they don't know how important, how vital it is. They are thirsty until somebody take their drink away from them, then realize that how much that important that water is.
Mm-hmm.
That's the problem with us.
And the problem
you know,
is
nice.
One. Mm-hmm.
And I'm in the car driving, and also I'll throw a couple of things in here because I'm about ready to get on the freeway, and I don't want to really be talking while I'm on the freeway. But, you know, Dr. Dew, what you just said was very, very important.
Yes.
Because we can lose freedom very quickly, and history bears that out. I teach Old Testament history. I've been teaching Old Testament history for 30 years. And the reason why I teach Old Testament history is because in that history you can see a pattern. You can see a pattern of what God expects, and at the same time, you can also see the pattern of man. And it's the pattern of man, and Ronald Reagan said this very clearly, that within a generation, you can lose your freedom.
Right.
And we've got a whole generation of young people right now that have been going through our schools. They have been going through our school system, which has not adequately taught them any kind of American exceptionalism, has not really taught them that history at different times will bear out some very, very horrid things. And it really doesn't. It doesn't take. We could see in the next 10 years, we could see our history bear out that we can really have bad things happen. And so that's why we're having this discussion, folks. That's why we're having this discussion as we come up to Memorial Day. That's why we're going to continue, Dan and I, as we do always, to have the discussion of freedom. Anyway, so I'm getting on the freeway, so I'm going to pass it back to you, and then I will pop in as soon as I get parked. Continue.
All right.
Yeah, you know, it's Scott and I have been waging this war for a number of years now, and trying to teach the American people that what the left is trying to show to you. It's like painting a picture saying how beautiful it is on the other side. If they show you one little piece and they don't show you the tyranny that exists. And this is what sharing your story and sharing Enrico's, and we have a bunch of people who from different parts of the world, and I think personally that sharing these stories is so very, very important. I remember sailing away from my home port for the last time, Newport, Rhode Island, and I remember looking back. I was on the schooner. And I remember looking back and watching get smaller and smaller and smaller. You know that feeling. And then all of a sudden it just disappears off the horizon. And I knew I could go back.
Uh-huh.
I knew that there was, you know, that was my job. And I knew that, you know, if I wanted to go back there, I could do it anytime I wanted to, you know. And even that kind of felt a little odd, I guess, for lack of any other description. And, you know, we look at what you had to do, leaving everything behind, and leaving a life that, you know, the only life you knew. As you arrived in America, I know that was your ultimate goal, but what city did you come into when you first arrived? When you arrived in the United States.
Oh, okay, I see. Well, my first step on this country was Hawaii first. But then you go flew to Hawaii to actually from Philippines to Hawaii, and then from Hawaii to San Francisco. So in the States here, I was a San Francisco city, and I lived there for a night before I flew. I flew from San Francisco to Houston. So Houston was the first city that I live in.
Oh, okay. Must have froze your butt off.
And Texan there, my friend. Texan.
Now
yes, Texan.
That.
Yes, you're U.S. Navy from Houston, Texas. Still remember that day. Yes.
I should
have gone
Dr.
a little
Newton,
further over to Baton Rouge.
Competition going on between us and him. He's in Florida, number two state to live in, and I'm in Texas, number one state to live in. And he was saying the other day, now I have Dr. Dew on. He's a Floridian, so it'll be two against one. Well, next week we're going to have a Texan on. I tell you, he was raised behind the Iron Curtain. So I thought, you know, I'm not going to have any help. But you're actually a Texan. We're going to call you a Texan. I'll hand it back to you.
Thank you.
Yeah, Scott was telling me, next week's guest lives in Texas. And I say, well, we all have our faults. Yeah, we have a nice little rivalry between our two states, and it's actually kind of fun to harass each other, you know. You know, Florida here is, you must have froze your butt off in San Francisco, though.
Yeah.
That's cold over there.
My first step on the land, USA here. Oh, wow, the feeling was so tremendous. It's just it's unbelievable. It's just, I could never believe that I made it that far. You know.
Oh, it must have been. You know, you've been striving for so long.
Right.
You made it
exactly.
Here.
Yeah.
It must have been like a sigh of relief. It's finally, you know.
Oh, yes.
You reached your destination. And, you know,
yeah.
Was it difficult getting used to the culture? As you know, because I know, you know, I've been to several Asian countries, and the culture is quite a bit different, and the food is definitely very different.
Yeah, the culture, the way of living, the you know, the custom, it's different. They're different. You know, the way we live in Vietnam is totally different. But I really, you know, it's harder to get to adapt into the new society, but then I do have a hard time, but you know, I don't have any problems, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Even the one when I joined U.S. Navy, I was in average I was much older than the youngster there. I was 25 when the others. Young fellow was 18 and 19 or 17, you know.
And you were the old man.
Right.
Yeah, I know most of the, you know, entry level by 25, you know, you're a lieutenant or above or something like that, or, you know, you're an E6, or, you know, you aren't entry level, so it must have been a little difficult. But it's, you know, to serve on the, I think it's so appropriate that you got assigned to the USS America.
I know. It's so unbelievable.
You know, and she served 3 tours in Vietnam.
Right.
You know, so you knew that. Some of the aircraft you saw flying overhead came from that very carrier.
Right.
You know, it's, you know, I had friends on the force, and USS Constitution and Nimitz and Enterprise.
Right.
You know, and it's amazing those, you know, you're on something so big, it's a floating city. I mean,
exactly right. It's about 5,000 to 6,000 sailors on that ship.
Yeah, I mean, I heard from friends of mine, they got lost even being, you know, having been on it for a year, and they said, every once in a while, you take a wrong corner. You're on the wrong.
That's right. I got love all the times.
Imagine, it was like big boats.
Right, it is. Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we'd hear the carrier forces when I was sailing. We'd hear a carrier force coming in, and of course, they would radio us and tell us to, you know, steer a different course. And there was one time we came a little bit too close. And, you know, your escort submarines, the 688s, one buzzed us. And you could actually feel the water go up and down as it went underneath us. And I was like, wow, geez. Interesting. Now we're on the second hour, and it's up to you if you want to continue.
It's okay. I would love to talk a lot more, but maybe it's time for you to spend with your time for your family for this Memorial Weekend, and we will do it again soon.
Okay, that's fantastic, because it's so interesting. I ordered your book. Sadly, I didn't get it yet, so I'm looking forward to reading it, and the next time we can discuss the book a little more in depth and, and go from there. And as I said, a book I recommend very highly is Betrayed by Billy Vaughn, V-A-U-G-H-N, available on Amazon.
Amazon or authorhouse.com. And the name of the book is The Escapes and My Journey to Freedoms. And
okay.
I really encourage all Americans to read this book.
Trust me, I'll be reading it, and once I'm done reading it, I'll let you know, and we can. I look forward to getting to know you a lot better over the years, and becoming closer friends, and This is a tribute to Du Hua, who is a recent but close friend of mine, and to all of those who fought in Vietnam. This is your day, and to the 58,000 who will never come back.
I
pay homage to you.
Dan and Scott, thank you so much for doing this. Thank you so much for Let the Words Out. I really appreciate that so much, and we hope we can talk more, and I hope one day I get to meet you.
Oh, you definitely will, because we are... We're only a few hundred miles apart. I mean, it's not.
All right.
Drive across Alligator Alley.
Just take here real quick, because I'm here, and if you can hear the dog barking, we're here to have a swim party. I'm going to walk outside so you can hear me better. Before we close out, I just want to really quickly run down. Don't forget, everybody, we've got next Tuesday, we've got American Sovereignty Radio with Jennifer Montrose and Dan and I. Next Thursday, we are going to have a great Conover U show. We are going to have three guests. We got Dave Souza, who we talked a lot about on this show, running for supervisor in El Dorado County. We've also got coming on the show Paul Arnold, who works really, really hard in the grassroots. Going to enjoy him. And Paul Hanash, who is running in the 8th District of California, running for Congress. He is going to be heading into his primary the first week in June. He's going against Paul Cook, who's got an R after his name, but I'm telling you, that man is a Democrat. So don't miss Conover U this next week. And then, of course, on Friday, ladies' Bible class. We don't want you to forget that. We're having a great time. We just watched the top 10 tribes be taken away into Assyrian captivity. We're going to follow Judah alone as they go over a couple of hundred-year period and then watch them taken into Babylonian captivity as the Babylonians conquer the Assyrian Empire. So that's what's going on. I want to thank big-time Dr. Du for coming on again. It's great to have you on. You're always welcome. We're going to continue to... let people know that you've got your book. You are in our prayers, definitely. And we want to wish you a very happy Memorial Day. We thank you for your service to this great country. And we thank you for
thank
the example
you.
That you're able to pass on to young people all over the country, because it's very, very important. And, Dan, with that, I'll pass it to you and let you close out the show.
Thank you so much.
And
the same to you.
For everybody out there, we're going to rebroadcast this on Memorial Day, so more of our veterans will be able to hear it. And again, Dr. Dewart, you know, thank you so much for coming on and sharing your story again with us. And I hope you have a wonderful Memorial Day weekend, and spend it with your family, and praise God that you're here in the United States. And I promise you, we're going to do our best to make sure that you never have to go through.
Yes. Thank you so much, Dan. And you enjoy your weekends, okay? And then we get in touch. We touch base very soon.
I promise. Yes, definitely. And,
thank you.
You're welcome.
To our listeners, please enjoy the weekend safely and think about our servicemen and women out there. Thank you.
Okay, and thank you. And this is Continued for Truth Radio, and for all you out there, we are going into syndication, so we'll be reaching a lot more people. And to all of you, I wish you a happy Memorial Day weekend, and looking forward to seeing you next week. We have a wonderful host guest coming on. And on Tuesday, we have, the Continued for Truth Radio, American Sovereignty, where we speak of the current issues and the relationships in our states, local, state, and national sovereignty. And I'm looking forward to talking to you then. Scott, back to you.
Thank you. Have a good
thank
one.
You. You too.
Thank you, sir.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Now, Scott, are you there?